whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Five Questions, where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kieran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. The first is that follow-up questions are allowed. If you're familiar with the hand-finger convention from philosophy discussion periods, where a hand means a new line of questioning and a finger is a follow-up, I am allowed to use my finger. And the other ground rule is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
I'm Kwame Antonyapia. I teach philosophy at NYU in the philosophy department and in the law school. Most of my work recently has been in ethics and politics, especially about questions to do with the ways in which identities matter for moral and political life. But I've done work in a lot of areas of the subject. My original work was on the semantics of conditionals in my dissertation. And I wrote a book about Michael Dummett's philosophy of language. And I've written about cosmopolitanism and a bunch of other things.
So before we get into the official questions, I want to ask you how you made the transition from working on semantics and philosophy of language and conditionals to the kind of work in moral and political philosophy and about identity that you've been doing more recently. How did that happen?
So when I finished at Cambridge, my first job was at Yale, and it was a joint appointment in philosophy and African and African American studies. And I had to think of something to do in African and African American studies, because at that point there was almost no work at the interface of philosophy and African and African American studies. I'm glad to say there's lots now, but I was accidentally, as it were, a pioneer. And it seemed to me that there were a bunch of things that a philosopher could usefully do to contribute to those fields. One was to get clearer about ideas about race, the race concept. And I had the advantage that I knew more biology than some philosophers, since I had spent a year in medical school before doing philosophy. And also that there were important ethical questions about racism. So not having worked on those things, but having to teach something in African-American and African studies, I thought those were things I should work on. So I started thinking about reading. Again, there wasn't a huge amount about those things in the kind of philosophy that I do at that point, but I started working on that. And the other thing I did was work on the history of Pan-Africanism, which is, again, I think, another important topic in the field of African and African-American studies. And that was of interest to me in part because my father had been involved in the Pan-African movement. He was at the 1945 Pan-African Congress in Manchester. And we knew some of the key figures in Pan-Africanism. W.B. Du Bois was living in Ghana when I was a child and was known to my family.
Wow.
But I had never really thought about it as an intellectual matter. I just, it was just, as it were, a thing in our lives. And it's a central question about relations between Africa and the diaspora, obviously, which is a central question in African and African American studies. And that led me to thinking about questions to do with the relationship between identity and politics, which is essentially what Pan-Africanism is about. So I was doing these things initially, A, because I was very interested in them, and B, because of my job, I was allowed to, and C, because I had to have things to teach that were relevant to half my appointment. So it happened in the way things often happen, I think, in academic life. There was partly a pedagogical pull. There was something that I needed to have courses to teach. But also, as often happens, at least in philosophy, it was because I had a personal interest in it. And one of the great advantages of philosophy is that almost anything you can be interested in has a philosophical dimension or philosophical dimensions, and you can work on pretty much anything that interests you. If you're interested in, why there are two theories of chemical bonding which seem to be incompatible with one another, both used by chemists, you could work on that as a philosophical problem. If you're interested in the history of nationalism, you can think about questions about nationalism and the state and so on. So anyway, that's how it happened.
Well, speaking of the intersection of personal interests and philosophy, I think I can transition to our first official question. which is inspired by Iris Murdoch. She begins each episode of the podcast saying that philosophy is not self-expression, but she also wrote, "To do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth." So does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
Oh, for sure. And as for how, well, one thing is, just as a matter of cultural background, I come from traditions that are remarkably anti-confrontational. Both my mother's English family and my father's family were raised you to think that it was not good to argue directly against other people. So my sort of personal style is very different from the natural style that developed in analytic philosophy, I think, which is very confrontational. The first time I ever gave a philosophy paper, I was an undergraduate at it was the Moral Sciences Club at Cambridge, and every so often they allowed an undergraduate to give a paper. And I gave a paper that actually was about something that Iris Murdoch had written about sort of moral exemplars, and I brought it together with some work of Mary Hesse's on models and analogies in science, and thinking about the ways in which models worked, these rather well-developed pictures of how models worked in the sciences struck me as having interesting things to say about how examples and models and you know, saints and other kinds of moral leaders work in the moral life. And at the end of the talk, there was a break, and then Elizabeth Anscombe, who was in the chair, began her questions by saying, she said, "We speak to each other across a great gulf." And she proceeded to sort of lay into me. That's very much not how I like to talk to people. I believe not in sort of adversarial, but in conversational philosophy. And that means that I have not, when I have written things that were very strongly critical of other people's views, I've mostly regretted it, actually, not because what I said was wrong, but because I think it would have been more apt from my point of view, for me, to do so in a way that was less directly adversarial. I don't believe that you make progress in the subject by being aggressive and upsetting people. People don't think well when they're upset. I think calmness is very important in deep thinking. So that aspect of my background and my temperament, which is also a non-confrontational temperament, I think does show up in the way that I like to do philosophy. Yeah, so that's my answer. Yes, temperament, I think, very much affects the way I write philosophy, the way I discuss philosophy with my students and with my colleagues, and the way in which I think progress in the subject is made.
Can I ask a follow-up about your experience as an undergraduate then? So it sounds like there was a clash, really, between your temperament and the sort of prevailing intellectual temperament of philosophy at Cambridge at the time. I mean, did you find that discouraging? How did you adapt to that?
Well, I learned philosophy at Cambridge almost entirely by doing two things, reading a lot and talking to my supervisors, my tutors. And they were all not like that. Uh-huh. I mean, they were very much not trying to, they were not bullies, any of them. I was taught by Philip Pettit, Ian McFetridge, Hugh Miller. They challenged you, but in a way that was meant to, as it were, lift you up rather than knock you down. And I should say that the response at that moral sciences meeting to the way that Elizabeth addressed me was that a lot of other people in the room thought that that was inappropriate, and
yeah,
I didn't have to defend myself very much for the rest of the evening because Bernard Williams and people like that made the best possible case for my position because they were annoyed at her for addressing an undergraduate in that way. So, but I do think, I mean, nevertheless, so at Cambridge it wasn't a problem, and I just, you know, I just loved the subject. It would have been hard to put me off it. And as I say, the people I learned the most from, my teachers, my living teachers, as opposed to the people in the books who were not all living, were not like that at all. They were very much people who sort of, as I say, lifted you up and drew you out, even though they challenged you.
Well, my second question is also in a way about temperament, maybe about character more broadly. So question two is there a trait you wish you had more of as a philosopher?
Yeah, I think I wish I were more able to sustain focus for long periods of time. One reason my work is a little bit all over the place is because I sort of move on from one thing to another. And, you know, I think That's fine, because often one of the, as I say, one of the pleasures of the subject is that you can follow anything that interests you. And I've often worked on things where there wasn't a lot already in place. And so, and often it's very rewarding to sort of start philosophical work in an area because there's so many things that are immediately, you know, leap out at you as philosophically interesting. But there's a lot to be said as well, obviously, for going, for digging deep. And I guess, you know, when I was a graduate student, I did that. My book on conditionals and my book on Dummett are go quite deep, and they, in the sense that they pursue the subject and into all sorts of technical intricacies and so on. But that isn't actually something I find it easy to do as a, you know, as a grown up in the subject, having to teach and do administration and all those other things as well. I find it hard. So I wish I, as it were, could wake up every morning and just dig deep into something for hours and hours and hours, but that's not how my mind works. So, and I've accepted that. So I'm constantly trying to find areas where I think there are things to be said that are relatively new, perhaps, but that don't, in the first place anyway, require that kind of deep, focused attention, the sort of attention that gets you to make, you know, very complicated technical proposals, which I admire. I mean, I think those are an important part of the subject.
I mean, if someone asked you to make a kind of counterfactual claim about what you might work on or would work on if you had the sort of unlimited powers of sustained attention, do you have an answer? Is there something that in particular that seems out of reach?
Well, I would have probably kept up with and gone on working on conditional semantics, but progress in that area now requires the you know, you have to read huge quantities of demanding technical work. And it's not that I don't find it interesting to do that, but I don't find it, but I would find it very hard, I think, now to you know, dig into the technicalities of many of those proposals in the way that I did do when I was a graduate student. I mean, as it happens, the proposal I made for conditional semantics, I think, is almost certainly wrong. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't be in the business of defending it. I think it was a very interesting idea, and that it was plausible, and you know, it was an idea that had been explored by a number of people, including David Lewis. But so I'm not saying that it was, as it were, silly, but it wasn't. I think it was wrong, and so it's not that I would have, you know, been busy defending that view for the last 30, 40 years, because as I say, I think it's not correct. But it, I mean, I'm not. This is not said in a mode of regret. Margaret Fuller once said, who was a 19th-century spiritualist, "I accept the universe." Well, I accept myself. I accept that I am what I am in these ways, and you know, I have my temperament is consistent with, and my intellectual abilities are consistent with making, I think, a contribution to the subject. So I'm not. It's not a matter of regret. But yeah, there are things that I would have worked on, continued working on, perhaps, if I did have that kind of stick-to-itiveness that I don't have.
Well, I'm going to move on to question three, which I'm very excited to ask you, in part because for a while now you've been the ethicist at the New York Times, and so I get to turn the tables slightly by asking you, has philosophy ever helped you out of a practical or emotional difficulty in your life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what brought me to philosophy in the first place was that in my late teens, I was in a group of very devout evangelical Christian students. And we were thinking a lot about and reading a lot of theology. And that, if you read theology, you end up turning to philosophy because the great modern theologians anyway are all profoundly influenced by philosophical ideas and philosophical work. And it really did helped me sort out what was for me an intensely emotional and personal practical problem, which was what I thought about theism. and by the time I got to university, I was no longer a theist, but I had gotten there with the help of all kinds of things. Russell, Ayer, Kant's suggestion that existence isn't a predicate, and so on. So that was very helpful. And now what was at stake for me was at least as much the fact that you know, as someone who was aware and at that point that I was gay, and who had been raised in a church at home in Ghana, that would have been pretty unhappy about that. There was the one of the practical problems of what I should think about my own sexuality. It was freeing not to have that reason for being concerned about my sexuality, the reason that it might be inconsistent with Christianity as well. So, but as I say, by the time I got to university, that was settled, sorted. But because in the course of getting there, I had ended up reading a lot of, I mean, I may be the only person whose religious life was reoriented by reading Language, Truth, and Logic, which was a book that I found in the school bookroom in my late teens. But it was, and that sense that there was something liberating about the kind of slashing and burning that the verification principle was supposed to do, a principle that I wouldn't any longer endorse, you know, that was also exciting. And so a lot of my interest from then on for a decade probably was in philosophy of language, which I'd come to by this slightly odd route.
Can I ask you a personal question that's a follow-up on that? Like, when you were in Cambridge sort of struggling with religion and sexuality, were you out in Cambridge at that point? And what was the atmosphere, or what was it like being gay in philosophy in, when was this? And this is in the 70s?
70s.
80s? Yeah.
Mid-70s. Yes, I was out mostly. And let's see, Ian McFetteridge, one of my teachers who died young, unfortunately, was openly gay. Hugh Mellor was gay. But honestly, that wasn't a big deal in my philosophical life. Mm-hmm. In my social life, this was a period, I would say Cambridge hasn't been a hard place to be gay for a very long time. Indeed, it, for men anyway, it was a relatively easy place to be gay, starting arguably in the early 20th century. By the time I came along, I would have said that it was kind of slightly fashionable to be gay. You couldn't have a party without a few gay people around to decorate the room, as it were.
Okay.
So it really wasn't a problem. I remember, apropos of the early 20th century, I remember Richard Braithwaite, who was a great Cambridge philosopher, but retired by the time I got there. But I knew him pretty well because I ended up spending time with a group called the Epiphany Philosophers that he was in. And his wife, Margaret Masterman, who was one of Wittgenstein's students, though like many of Wittgenstein's students, she was thrown out for asking too many questions or doubting too many of his pronouncements. I remember once Margaret said something about homosexuality, and Richard, very crossly, having been an apostle in the early 20th century and mm-hmm. in a very gay circle, said to her, "Margaret, you know nothing about homosexuality, and I do because I was one." So I wouldn't have said Cambridge was a hard place to be. At least, I don't know. I mean, maybe for someone who came from a background where it was a problem, it would have been difficult. And maybe, you know, there were other things that might have made it difficult. But in itself, I don't think it was a problem. It was a very, a pretty gay-friendly place.
So you mentioned earlier the role in your education of reading the great dead philosophers. So question four is about that. It's, if you could go back in time and meet a past philosopher, who would it be and why?
I did have sort of two very different thoughts about this question, about two different people. But I think in the end, I settled on the one that I think is the philosopher who's been most important to me. And it doesn't involve going back very far in time. And that's Frank Ramsey. Uh-huh. He's another Cambridge philosopher who died, unfortunately, at the age of 26, brother of Archbishop Ramsey, who was later on Archbishop of Canterbury, whose work is all in, as it were, one volume. But it's important work in mathematics, in economics, in philosophy, and the foundations of decision theory, and so on. And I would also say that I realized quite late in my life that there was a feature of his method that either consciously or unconsciously, I think unconsciously, but I think genuinely, was shaped by the way he went about things. So there's something called making the Ramsey sentence of a theory, which involves taking out all the problematic terms and replacing them with a variable. And so you try to understand the term by saying it's the X such that, and then, you know, it has all these relationships that are embedded in the sentences. of the theory. Well, what that means in practice, and this shows up very much in what's called functionalism in the philosophy of mind, which is a very much a creation in some ways of Ramsey, because functionalism essentially is about creating the Ramsey sentence of our theory of mind, is that I think what functionalism does in this Ramsey-inspired way is to explain concepts by identifying three things about them. One is, under what conditions do sentences involving the concept get uttered, or thoughts about the concept become appropriate? In other words, the input conditions, the conditions that make the concept, claims involving the concept come to life and come to be believed and asserted. How that concept interacts with other concepts, and not just with, as it were, the perceptual and other inputs, but with other concepts. And finally, what it makes you do to have a belief with that concept. And so that those three things, the kind of what you could think of in a way as growing out of positivism as the verification conditions of an utterance, the circumstances under which it's you have reason to think that it's true or false, falsification conditions, the conceptual interactions that the concepting is has with other concepts in the area, and then something that comes out of more out of pragmatism, which is something that Ramsey was influenced by, which is the thought that concepts and ideas and truths are fundamentally, Ramsey says, beliefs are states on which we act. So that the third thing, which comes out of pragmatism when you're trying to understand a concept, is what do people do because they have this concept? What does thinking that something is an X make them do? It turns out that looking backwards, I realized that when I started working, say, on race, that's what I was doing. I was trying to understand under what circumstances people invoke the race concept, how it relates to a bunch of other concepts, and then what do people do when they have race beliefs, and so on. And the same is true for my work on identity. It can be conceived of in that Ramseyan way. So it would have been wonderful to talk to the man who invented this method, partly because he was just, so far as I can tell, very smart on anything you talk to him about, and just someone who had enormous pleasure in intellectual work. So I think it would have been great to spend time with him and to discuss things with him.
Yeah, I was recently reading Cheryl Mizek's wonderful biography of Ramsey, mm-hmm. and part of the sense you get from that is that despite being formidably intelligent, too intelligent, faster than anyone around him, he was not intimidating, he was modest, he would have been a fun person to talk to.
He was very kind.
Yeah, it seems like he was kind of defied the tortured genius stereotype.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and he had fun.
But I can't resist asking, at least briefly, who was you said there were two people and you went with Ramsey, who was the other option?
Oh, well, it's slightly more boring, I think, but it would have been Aristotle.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, this is a guy who, like Ramsey, thought about everything. He was a man of his time, so he had the wrong views about slaves and women and lots of other topics. But that sense of sort of being at the beginning of a subject, I think particularly in ethics, though he was obviously also enormously influential in the history of metaphysics, I think it would have been very interesting to spend time talking to Aristotle. But I think it would have been very hard, not least because I don't have the necessary Greek.
Yes.
But also because of those big sort of cultural differences. Whereas Ramsey, I feel, is a very modern person. I mean, I think Ramsey would be, wouldn't seem out of place in the present, in the very present, 100 years or so after he was in his prime. So, anyway, for me, one reason I mention Ramsey is because I think Cheryl's book is going to make him better known as a person. I suppose a certain number of us do recognize how central his ideas have been to a whole bunch of things. I mean, I should say that, a lot of the work in my dissertation involved using probabilities and in particular subjective probabilities. And of course, he really, on the philosophical side, was the person who invented the modern way of thinking about subjective probability. In fact, I think of myself as belonging in a tradition which goes through Keynes and Ramsey, who were both apostles who wrote about probability, came to Braithwaite, who was their friend and who was one of the people to introduce decision theory into ethics. Ian Hacking, these are all Cambridge people, Cambridge dissertations, as it were, who was teaching when I was there, and Hugh Mellor, who was my dissertation advisor, who was also a probability person. So I think of myself, my early work as belonging in a tradition of work about probability that Ramsey, in a way, is at the root of.
Okay, I'm going to ask you the final question, back to Murdoch, beginning with another quote. "It's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher," she wrote, "what is he afraid of?" So what are you afraid of?
I think I'm afraid of holding on to ideas longer than you should and not being sufficiently willing to change my mind about things. And now, I mean, I don't mean I haven't changed my mind about things. I said earlier that I don't think that the proposal for the probabilistic conditional that I made is correct. And when I say I made, I defended it at great length. It was, the proposal wasn't made by me. It was made by Ernest Adams. So I have changed my mind about lots of things. I've changed my mind a good deal about how to understand race thinking and racism. I'm much less critical of appeals to identity than I think I was at the start of my thinking about these things. So I don't mean I haven't changed my mind, but changing your mind can be uncomfortable. It can, if it's in ethics, it can require you not just to change your mind, but to change your life. And to behave differently and to support different causes and so on. And that's a reason, an unconscious reason, of course, why one can be hesitant to do it. So I wish I were, I'm afraid of intellectual change. And I worry that I'm too set in my intellectual ways and I'm afraid that there's not much I can do about it, though I remind myself regularly that this is what I think in order to try to keep myself open. Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of non-philosophical things, I think I'm always worried that our society will tip over into a kind of massive disruption produced by division and divisiveness. And I think part of my hope about the work I've done on identity is that it provides people with who are willing to attend to that sort of thing, which is not, of course, most of the population, ways of avoiding that kind of tipping over into intolerance.
Well, thank you so much for appearing on the podcast and for answering all these questions. It's been really great to talk to you.
Thanks for asking me. I enjoyed it.
That was Kwame Anthony Appiah. He's professor of philosophy and law at NYU and the author of several books, including Experiments in Ethics, As If, and The Lies That Bind, Rethinking Identity. Thanks for listening to 5 Questions.